Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Planned Parenthood video sting reignites the abortion debate. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Undercover videos show Planned Parenthood executives discussing payment for fetal tissue, and it sparked investigations into the Women's Health Group. Planned Parenthood calls it a deceptive campaign by abortion foes to misrepresent their work and discredit them. The group behind the recordings says clinics are illegally selling tissue from aborted fetuses for profit. The controversy is all about the ethics of medical research, but is the real goal to make a woman's right to choose harder than ever, just in time for the next election cycle? And today's talking point, big money and new discoveries in the search for alien life. First, the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
We're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, Planned Parenthood is playing defense after two undercover videos appear to show executives discussing the price of fetal tissue left over from abortions for medical research. A new front in the abortion wars coming up. And later on today's talking point, is anybody out there? The search for extraterrestrial intelligence got a $100 million boost this week from a Russian tycoon. But do we even know where to look and what we'll say when we find something? First, this news update. The Obama administration's sales pitch to Congress on the Iran nuclear deal began today. Secretary of State John Kerry and Secretary of Energy Ernest J. Moniz testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Congress has less than 60 days to accept or reject the deal. Critics, including Idaho Republican Senator Jim Risch, railed against the agreement as too soft on Iran.
With all due respect, you guys have been bamboozled, and the American people are going to pay for that.
And Senator Kerry has been making the case for the administration.
The way we lose is by rejecting the deal, because then you have no restraints. You have no sanctions. You have no insight. You have no inspectors. You have no diminution of their centrifuges. You have no reduction of their stockpile.
John Hudson is a senior reporter for Foreign Policy, and it is good of you to join us today.
Good to be with you, Barbara.
So remind us of the main points in the deal and which of them is raising this rallying cry that the administration has been bamboozled.
The core aspect of this deal is an exchange for restrictions on Iran's nuclear program and in return, the lifting of economic sanctions on Iran. And a number of Republicans have stated their opposition to the deal because they don't want to see Iran, an adversary of the United States, to be given additional sanctions relief. The administration have shot back, well, what's a better alternative? We're getting rid of a nuclear bomb in Iran's hands, and that should be at the forefront.
Well, Secretary of State Kerry today said the talk of a better deal being reached with Iran is just fantasy, pure and simple. But how airtight is his case, since Republicans are arguing that the U.S. could impose harsher restrictions on Iran?
Yeah, so the Republican complaint is that a better deal is possible in some way. And the Obama administration says, look, we've been doing this for 2 years. For two years, we had the opportunity to walk away from the deal. We had the opportunity to get a bad deal, and we maintained a hard line, and we got the best thing that we could have gotten. Republicans say we wanted a deal that completely eliminated and dismantled Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And in response, the administration says anytime you begin a negotiation, it is inherently a negotiation. You don't get everything you want. So while the best case scenario would have been an Iran that gives up all of its nuclear infrastructure and declares a writes a love letter to Israel, that's not going to happen, and they got the best thing they could have gotten.
Well, how much support does the deal have among Democrats at this point?
So it's mixed. It's certainly mixed. And this is why this was such an important hearing, because Congress has, as you noted, 60 days to vote on this. And a number of Democrats are sort of being pulled in two directions. They have a lot of pro-Israel constituents. There's a lot of pro-Israel lobbying happening on this issue, tens of millions of dollars. They're being told to break with the president and stand with pro-Israel constituents. And a number of Democrats have been slow to declare a position on what they're going to take, and that's a result of them facing this immense amount of pressure. So it's unclear. Many of the positions of the key Democratic Party leaders, Charles Schumer hasn't said where he's standing on this. You also don't have a firm declaration from the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Ben Cardin. So really, the sales pitch is coming at a key time, and those Democrats want to hear that this is an airtight deal that they can get behind.
And Israel, of course, is a main critic of the deal. And today, Senator Marco Rubio posed a hypothetical asking whether the deal obligated the U.S. to protect Iran if, say, Israel carries out an airstrike against a nuclear site in Iran. So across the board, on both sides of the divide, is there real concern that the deal strongly allies the powers against Israel?
Yeah, so it's bipartisan, the support for Israel, and because the Israeli government under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has so forcefully come out against this deal, it's led a lot of lawmakers to pause and say, well, you know, this is our traditional ally. At the same time, this is a right-wing Israeli government that has really frayed relationships in the administration, in the White House. And quite frankly, Secretary Kerry had to push back and say, but Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is wrong on this issue. And Israeli opinion, in fact, is mixed. And Secretary Kerry came into the briefing citing all the numbers of former Israeli security officials who have gotten behind this deal and gone public. And he actually, during the hearing, he cited a blog post in the Washington Post just a few minutes ago. I was listening in on the hearing. Another Republican lawmaker came out and saying, hey, that's a blog post. It wasn't even in the newspaper. So things are really getting tense, and this was quite a standoff on Capitol Hill today.
Thanks so much for talking with us today. John Hudson, he's senior reporter for Foreign Policy. When we come back, scrutiny of Planned Parenthood reignites the abortion wars. So stay with us for that conversation on To the Point.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave for Warren Olney. In the past 2 weeks, the Center for Medical Progress, a group headed by longtime anti-abortion activist David Daleiden, has released two videos of Planned Parenthood officials discussing the price and methods for providing fetal tissue from abortions for medical research. And more videos are coming. The group reportedly has thousands of hours of footage from covert recordings gathered over the past 2.5 years. They allege Planned Parenthood illegally sells fetal tissue for profit. The undercover sting has already prompted congressional and state investigations into Planned Parenthood's practices. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, and she joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us more about these two videos. Who appears in them? What's the setting? And what of controversy is said? For those of us who haven't actually watched them.
The videos involve doctors who work for Planned Parenthood talking about fetal tissue. And what they say are donations of fetal tissue that women who have abortions ask for because there are really important medical benefits that can be gained from using this tissue. The setting of the first video, which got the most attention, was in a restaurant, and so there's this very kind of casual atmosphere in the video, and yet some, you know, very, from the point of view of a lay audience, some, you know, pretty gruesome details are being discussed because that's often how doctors talk. And so one of the questions the video raises is what exactly is Planned Parenthood doing with this medical tissue and what kind of money is changing hands? Planned Parenthood has said very clearly that the money it receives, which is a low sum according to the video, is going purely for transportation and storing, and that there's no profit being made by Planned Parenthood on this tissue.
So do in the videos, do the Planned Parenthood officials say anything that would be considered questionable or illegal in their practices with the fetal tissue?
I don't think there's any direct evidence of illegality, but I think the issue that medical ethicists who are not necessarily abortion opponents have pointed to is this question of whether, in some instances, if an abortion provider knows that there's a need for fetal tissue that involves a particular organ, like the liver or the heart, are they in some way changing how they do the procedure that would allow for the collection of that tissue? And then if that's happening, is that a problem because it means that the medical procedure is being done in such a way that it's not purely about the health and safety of the woman, which is obviously a doctor's foremost concern.
Now, Planned Parenthood, as I said, says the conversations are misrepresenting the organization and also that the group that recorded these videos, the Center for Medical Progress, used misleading editing and took statements out of context. What evidence is there to back up that accusation of misrepresentation?
Oh, well, this seems very clear. I mean, these are really long tapes, and they have been edited heavily. And in particular, this accusation that Planned Parenthood is somehow profiting, if you see the full video, which the Center for Medical Progress did later make available, the doctor from Planned Parenthood is saying repeatedly she's not talking about making a profit. She's talking about transportation costs. But if you simply watch the edited version, that is not at all clear, and that's been one of the most incendiary charges here, that we're talking about, you know, this kind of suspicious market for fetal tissue as opposed to donations that are being done in an ethical manner for the purposes of furthering science.
And tell us more about the background of the Center for Medical Progress. What is it and who is David Daleiden, the force behind it?
Well, he's a longtime abortion opponent, and this is an organization that, you know, created a front company so that these Planned Parenthood officials were thinking they were dealing with a company that buys and sells medical tissue. And so, you know, there's like a very concerted effort here to embarrass and kind of catch Planned Parenthood in some way. And this is a tactic we've seen another group called Live Action use, in which they are, you know, very much deploying hidden cameras and other concealed tactics to try to get Planned Parenthood officials to say something that will cause trouble for abortion rights generally and for Planned Parenthood in particular.
And what's of note about the timing of this? How might this controversy play out politically? And David Daleiden has said he has footage for maybe a dozen more videos that could be coming out in the next weeks and months. So what fallout do you see, both in terms of Congress finalizing spending bills before October for organizations like Planned Parenthood and as well as for the presidential primary?
Right. I think those are exactly the two political contexts in which this is relevant. So will there be enough heat about these videos that Republican leaders in the House and Senate will try to hold up the spending bills, the, you know, big budget bills, over their demands to defund Planned Parenthood? That has been a long-sought goal from the right. However, it's not really had mainstream political support in Washington, and so the question is, will these videos change that? And then the second issue is the presidential contest, in which I believe at this point most of the Republican candidates have made very strong statements against Planned Parenthood. And, you know, this is, if you're an abortion opponent, this is very safe ground. This is like a politically helpful conversation to have because it brings up this issue of fetal tissue, which most voters are not familiar with and may very well be uncomfortable with, at least until they really think about this issue of medical benefits. And then the other, issue here is that you're really focusing people's attentions on later-term abortions, and that is always a better conversation for abortion opponents to be having than early-term abortions, even though that is the vast majority of the procedures that actually take place in the United States.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer of the New York Times Magazine. Let's bring Molly Hemingway into the conversation. She's senior editor at The Federalist. That's a web magazine focused on culture, politics, and religion. And it's good to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
So I'd like to give you a chance to respond to Emily Bazelon's characterization of whether these two videotaped conversations reveal troubling or legally actionable practices at Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to say at this point. I have watched the full unedited videos in both cases. And what was interesting about the first video, which was with Dr. Deborah Nakatola, who's a senior medical official with Planned Parenthood, was that while the people posing as buyers of the fetal tissue kept on referring to it as fetal tissue, she was actually quite explicit in talking about how she can get the organs, the hearts, the livers, the lungs, even the brains out of these children, and how she alters the abortion procedure to secure those parts. And there are some pretty serious questions about that, since the value of the organs depends on how recently deceased the body is. And so there are a lot of questions about how that's been done, and I think we don't really have the answers right now.
Although I think anyone watching this, if you heard two emergency room doctors, for instance, discussing this, I mean, the context is medical professionals discussing tissue donation, which is a large industry and does happen in all aspects of medical research all the time. So it's kind of a shop talk context.
It is. And what's interesting about this is that a lot of the rhetoric surrounding abortion requires us to sort of use euphemisms and not consider the victim of the abortion a human child. But all of a sudden, when the parts of that victim are valuable, well, then the humanity is quite clear. We're talking livers, organs, you know, we're very specific about it. So I think that's why it's touching people on that first video. Now, the second video was in many ways more interesting than the first. That was with Dr. Mary Gatter, and it's kind of a lengthy session where they're negotiating over prices. After the first video came out, Planned Parenthood's top official, Cecile Richards, emphasized that Planned Parenthood, this is not a revenue stream for Planned Parenthood. They don't make a lot of money out of this, which wasn't really the claim of the undercover anti-abortion activists. But in the second video, they really get to haggling over prices. And if Planned Parenthood truly only cared about being reimbursed for costs, there is no reason she wouldn't have negotiated. She would have just simply said what the costs were. She wouldn't have talked about bumping up the price if it was too low. She wouldn't have named the cost, and she would have just given the cost, and that would have been it. Instead, they're talking wildly various numbers, which shows a negotiation that undermines Planned Parenthood's argument.
Molly Hemingway, she's senior editor at The Federalist, a website. Bonnie Steinbuch is professor emeritus of philosophy at the University at Albany, State University of New York. She's also the author of Life Before Birth, The Moral and Legal Status of Embryos and Fetuses. And I'd like you, first of all, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
I'd love it if you could pick up on some of Molly Hemingway's points. Do you agree that this undercover sting at Planned Parenthood has raised real, significant, troubling, or even bordering on illegal issues in the practice of dealing with the fetal tissue left over from abortion?
Well, I'm not a lawyer and don't pretend to be a lawyer, so I will confine myself to the ethics as a bioethicist and philosopher. I just want to say before I get into the question about the negotiation and whether that changes the discussion about whether it's compensation or selling, I do object to the characterization of the human fetus as a human child. Although I will point out, I mean, because it's not in law, and I would argue that there's significant differences between the fetus and the born child. But I will point out that there have been cases, and there are cases, in which parents tragically lose a child and wish to donate organs. And some of you may remember a number of years ago, this happened in Italy, where they were astounded that this American couple wanted to donate organs after their child was killed. And I believe that was actually a murder. He was shot in the crossfire or something, and they wanted to give something back. So donating of organs, even of dead children, is not something that is unheard of or unique to this situation. I do think it's troubling. She makes a fair point that if it is simply compensation for costs, you should be able to say what those costs are and then be reimbursed for it. So I think that is troubling. And the other thing that's troubling, as many people have pointed out, is the idea that you would change the methodology of the abortion in order to get intact organs or intact tissue. It seems to me that the appropriate thing to do is, I mean, why are they doing this anyway? Because there are women who would like to donate. They would like some good to come out of something that is not a happy situation. And they are well aware of the importance of the medical research. I think it's all research at this point and not medical uses. I believe that's true. But also, I'm not a doctor and I'm not a scientist, so if I'm wrong about that, I can be corrected. So they want to do this. And then the question is there a way in which you can help them achieve that goal? It seems to me that if you have two methods that are medically identical in terms of the health and safety of the pregnant woman, transparency requires you to say, we have method A, we have method B. There is no difference between the two methods as to your health and safety.
Which is what the medical director in the video actually said.
That's right. Mm. That's right. And if she's right about that, it would seem to me as part of the informed consent process, you would say, if you wish to donate, we think A would be better. And then if the woman says, no, I don't want A, I want B, then you would have to say, well, then you may not be able to donate. You have to understand what you are consenting to. Why not just put that in there in the interest of transparency?
So this is about transparency in a certain aspect, a certain area of medical tissue donation. Bonnie Steinbeck, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at the University of Albany, SUNY. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. Could you tell us more about the market for this kind of fetal tissue?
There are companies who provide fetal tissue to medical researchers, and those prices, from what we've learned about them, do seem to be high. So somebody probably is making some money here, even if it's not Planned Parenthood. I should also say that the researchers have made clear that this fetal tissue is particularly valuable to them, and they really value it highly in their work. So the notion that science may be progressing because of these kinds of donations seems like a very real possibility.
And I know you have to go. You have to leave us at the break. But before we let you go, could you fill us in more on what polling tells us about where Americans stand on abortion right now and just how central this issue of fetal tissue is to people on either side of the debate?
I'm not sure we know how central the issue of fetal tissue is. You know, abortion is this enduringly, incredibly divisive issue in American society, and the numbers of people who oppose abortion, who support abortion, have not significantly changed since Roe versus Wade in 1973, which is perhaps remarkable. I think the other thing, though, that we often forget in the polls is that lots of Americans see some kind of middle ground, even if it is not completely, consistent as a kind of pure moral or legal position. They understand that there are often cases in which women feel that they can't raise a child. And yet at the same time, they're uncomfortable with abortion that has zero restrictions on it whatsoever, because I think there's an intuitive understanding that when a fetus approaches the end of term, and the closer one gets to the idea of viability, that the fetus can live on its own, then people, have a lot of Americans have a sense at that point
and,
that
and
the fetus should have more rights.
And we'll talk more about that after the break. Emily Bazelon, writer at the New York Times Magazine. Thanks very much for joining us. And as I said, after the break, we'll continue our conversation about the undercover sting at Planned Parenthood and the broader implications it holds for the politics of abortion. Stay with us. That's next on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave for Warren Olney. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Planned Parenthood sting by an anti-abortion group which went undercover to record conversations about the organization's practice of providing fetal tissue for medical research. The covert videos have prompted investigations into Planned Parenthood and rekindled the abortion debate among Republicans in Congress and on the presidential trail. Bonnie Steinbach is professor emeritus of philosophy at the University at Albany, State University of New York. She's also the author of Life Before Birth, the Moral and Legal Status of Embryos and Fetuses. And Bonnie, before we broke, our guest Emily Bazelon was talking about how divisive a topic late-term abortion is in the abortion debate. And I'm curious how your thinking about late-term abortion influences your thinking about the ethics of the growing number of restrictions that are placed on earlier-term abortions and that contribute to delays for women seeking abortion, things like waiting periods, counseling, access problems in rural clinics, funding, what place this has in this debate and this controversy.
Well, I think it's very important, as Emily pointed out, that the vast majority of abortions take place very early. Actually, many, many of them, 60%, I believe, even within the first 8 weeks, and about 90% within the first trimester. Now, when I wrote my book, and the first edition came out in 1992, the idea of time limits on post-viability abortions seemed kind of reasonable to me. After all, you had all that time to make up your mind, and the closer the fetus gets to, in both appearance and in capacities to a newborn baby, all of our protective instincts kick in. So what seemed to me more important than viability was its capacity to experience or sentience, which happens probably somewhere about the same time as viability. But, you know, I changed my mind between the earlier edition in 1992 and the second edition, which came out in 2012. And the reason I changed my mind about restrictions on late-term abortions is because of the reality of late-term abortions. It's not the case that women or some women or a few women have late-term abortions because they simply cannot make up their minds. Virtually all women know very, very quickly whether this is an acceptable pregnancy or not. What happens in late-term abortions is perhaps a condition that she didn't have earlier that is threatening to her health or even her life begins, and all of a sudden, the situation, she had a wanted pregnancy, and now she has to terminate that pregnancy or face serious threats to her own life and health. Sometimes there are conditions that are incompatible with life in the fetus. And because these things, this is the vast majority of late-term abortion, it seems to me that putting additional restrictions on them is just coming between a woman and her doctor. So I support what George Tiller, the murdered abortion provider in Kansas, had put on buttons for his staff. It said, "Trust women."
Bonnie Steinbach with the University at Albany, SUNY. Molly Hemingway, she's senior editor at The Federalist, a web magazine focused on culture, politics, and religion. You have been so critical of how, very critical of how the media in general has covered this story involving Planned Parenthood and fetal tissue. And given that the context for that story is this very sensitive, larger debate about the ethics of abortion, tell us more about your criticism of the media. What are they not getting right? What are they not addressing?
Well, It's been really interesting to see how the media have covered this story. First off, with their reluctance to even note it. As soon as the video came out, it went viral. It was there were so many people tweeting about it, sharing it on Facebook and whatnot. But it took basically the entire business day for the first mainstream media outlet to even write an initial story on it. And the questions that are raised by these videos, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of questions raised about, you know, the ethics of the consent form. How much money are we really talking about? What's done with the fetal tissue? How many loopholes are people are swimming through and whatnot. But the media just seem very reticent to even get into it. They rely on euphemisms when talking about the part. They don't quote the actual salacious quotes that you're seeing in this video. I mean, one doctor talks about how she'll crush the unborn child below the organs or above the organs, depending on which organ she's trying to get. In the second video, she talks about how she uses a less crunchy technique if she's trying to preserve the organs of the aborted child. And they don't even include those quotes in there. And they just have shown such reluctance. I thought about this after the Kermit Gosnell trial, which the media really did kind of acknowledge at the end of that trial that they hadn't done a good job covering it. This was the abortion doctor in Philadelphia who is now in prison for serial murder. He didn't just deliver live children and kill them. He also, there was at least one woman that he killed as part of his abortion practices. He also was harvesting organs from the children, and they didn't cover this until they were basically shamed into covering it by pro-life activists who were outraged.
Molly Hemingway, she's senior editor at The Federalist. Charles Camosi is associate professor of theology at Fordham University, the Jesuit University of New York. He's also the author of Beyond the Abortion Wars, A Way Forward for a New Generation. And I'd like to bring your voice into the mix. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Barbara.
I'd like you to respond to the comments that Molly Hemingway was just making, because you have written and thought a lot about how the dialogue around abortion is flawed in the U.S., and she's raising some of those questions and also citing a media failure to quote, incendiary language.
Yeah, well, the language was the language of the video, right? So one thing that I think we could all benefit from is just an honest reporting of the facts regardless of our politics. And clearly that's not what's happening on either side, right? So on the far right politics, we have all this references to, you know, Nazi medicine and evil. And on the far left, we have virtually nothing. So can I agree with Molly that the traditional media needed to do a better job? And can I agree that the far right media is just way over the top? Can we find a way to accurately report what's going on here? It was interesting to see Professor Steinbach agree that there were serious problems here. That would be a good starting point, I think, for the media.
So does this current controversy, you think, over Planned Parenthood provide another example of how poisonous our debate is, or how we should change it, what the shift in the debate should be? I mean, what the third way is?
Yeah, I think so. I think almost every public disaster like this, in terms of a discourse, is a way to fight a war, right? In my book, I use the term abortion wars. And that shouldn't be the way we should think about it, right? We should think about this as an argument where we present evidence and we try to think about this very logically and systematically. But unfortunately, every single one of these disasters is considered to be the end of the world if you lose. And can't we admit, as several of your guests have pointed out, that first trimester abortion is a different kind of argument than these kinds of abortions? The first video, the doctor in the first video talked about the fact that she had just aborted a 16-week-old child that day. Can we have a discussion about 16 weeks is different than, say, 7 weeks? If so, I think things would go a lot better. But unfortunately, we sort of lump all abortions into this big mess and we see the results.
Charles Camosi, he's associate professor of theology at Fordham University. Molly Hemingway with The Federalist, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that comment.
I think, actually, I agree quite a bit. The debates we have are not very healthy. And while there's a fairly large percentage of people that are very consistently pro-choice through the entire pregnancy, there's a similarly large percentage who are consistently pro-life. But really, a plurality, probably like 40%, kind of go back and forth on this issue. They do think that abortion is not a good thing. They also are not advocates of making it illegal in the first trimester, let's say. And these types of stories are actually interesting because of the way that they affect the way this mushy middle, so to speak, not to denigrate them by any means, think about this topic. And unfortunately, the people who are really strident on both sides dominate the conversation to the detriment of some deep thinking in general by society.
Molly Hemingway with The Federalist, Bonnie Steinbach with the University at Albany, SUNY. How should we differentiate these different stages of abortion, as really both of our guests are recommending?
Before I get into that question, I think there's an important distinction that needs to be made. And that is between thinking that abortion is a good, bad, neutral thing on the one hand, and deciding that it is the government's decision to regulate it or to take the choice away from women. Because there are many things that people might think are not so great, but we let people make their own choices about it. Consider divorce, for example. Now, I think that one thing that people on the anti-abortion side could do in terms of making the language more neutral is to talk about fetuses when we're talking about abortion and children when we're talking about born. I know they don't think about it that way, but the minute we start talking about children, that changes the entire conversation.
Molly Hemingway with The Federalist, Charles Camosi, what do you think of that? Is that what the real issue is, or are we talking more less about language at this point and more about logic?
Well, I think it's interesting. Language is important, right? So it's interesting that in other contexts, we do use the word child. Nobody ever heard of a fetus bump. It's, of course, a baby bump. When the OB is talking about a wanted child, she says, to her patient, she says, hey, your baby's doing great. So we need to find a consistent way to talk about this. I think that would be really helpful. I don't know, in my book, I alternate between prenatal child and fetus as a way of trying to parse this out. But I really think we need to move beyond the language at a certain point and just look at what people happen to think. And what they happen to think is actually pretty complicated and doesn't fit into the abortion wars paradigm.
And what does that say about policy? And you talk in your book about the need for women to have more support in order to have a true choice, and that's part of another way in which we move beyond the abortion wars to a more sustainable dialogue about this.
Yeah, this is one of my most frustrating aspects of the debate for me, is that we seem to have this war which has conservatives fighting for babies and liberals fighting for women. And there's plenty of common ground for both, right? A substantial number of liberals would identify as pro-life. A substantial number of conservatives would want to support women. But there really isn't a legislative or even political pathway for that. So, for instance, the 20-week ban, which is in the Senate, which is about to be voted on in a few weeks, is, I think, a very popular piece of legislation. But it could be made even more popular if it would have supports for women. But it's not clear how that is going to work out, given our current political arrangements, which are really quite outdated from the 1970s. I'm hopeful, however, that a new generation of millennials will help us think differently and help us refuse to choose between women and children.
Charles Camosi with Fordham University. Molly Hemingway with the website The Federalist. What action should Congress take? And already Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and others have said they want to defund Planned Parenthood. That's one path that's been put on the table, but already no federal money goes directly to abortions. Planned Parenthood also provides birth control, also contributes to, if we're talking about different stages of this of a pregnancy and of this debate, it is more than just an abortion provider. So what's
right.
Constructive?
Well, Planned Parenthood receives $540 million a year in taxpayer funding at both the federal and state levels. And so I think you will see quite a few elected officials wondering whether an organization that, you know, that behaves the way we've seen on these tapes should be getting so much funding, and also whether there might be a way to provide that funding to health clinics that aren't tied so closely to abortion. There are tons of community medical centers that don't engage in abortion that do serve their communities, both male and female, with all sorts of things from, you know, sexual health and contraception to just general care. I also think, though, that you're going to see much more interest in investigating the organ trade. The laws governing this were were written, you know, some time ago, and they explicitly prohibit the sale of organs, but that doesn't mean that you can't exchange them for money. And you might wonder, you know, what the difference is, but I think it speaks to what a big loophole that is. And so I think you might see some much more interest in what are the regulations governing this trade and how much is Planned Parenthood involved with this? They do perform, I think it's 330,000 abortions a year, and they definitely have a corner on that market. So that's probably where most of the interest will lie.
Molly Hemingway with The Federalist. Bonnie Steinbach, author of Life Before Birth. If we could end on a very a broader context for this whole conversation, there's a new report out from the CDC, and it says that the number of American teenagers having sex is at its lowest rate in 25 years, but that contraceptive use hasn't increased, that most of these kids are using the withdrawal method, notoriously unreliable method. What connection do you see between this news about kids and abortion, and how... whether this is resulting in fewer American women getting abortions, and how does this inform the abortion debate as it moves forward?
Well, I agree with Charles that one of the things that would be very helpful is if pro-life and pro-choice advocates on both sides could join hands on the issues that should unite them. And I would say if you want to avoid abortions, you have access to birth control to teenagers, education, sex education that involves an emotional component as well as the physiology, so that young women have enough support to be able to say no when they don't want to have sex, and young men too. I think all of that is terribly important, and I think if we could join hands on that, we could reduce the number of abortions. But let me just say one more thing. If you want to increase the number of late abortions, if you want women to have to wait, then what you do is you don't fund it, you don't have abortion providers in 80% of counties, and so it's very inconsistent to say, oh, we're so much against late abortions, and then do all of the things that actually force women to delay abortions, planning how to get to travel to one, trying to raise the money, figuring out where they can leave the kids that they already have if they have children. Those are things that we could work together to end, so that for women who want to end their pregnancies, they can do so as quickly as possible and not have late abortions.
Bonnie Steinbach, Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany, State University of New York, also author of Life After Birth. Charles Camosi is Associate Professor of Theology at Fordham University and author of Beyond the Abortion Wars. Molly Hemingway with the website The Federalist. And earlier we heard from Emily Bazelon with the New York Times. I want to thank all of you for taking part in the conversation. Really interesting. Thank you. Just today, NASA officials announced they discovered a new Earth-like planet that may be habitable. It's been named Kepler-452b, so maybe there's extraterrestrial life out there after all. Well, a Russian bigwig has just thrown $100 million into the search. That's in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Warren Olney with today's Talking Point. The search for extraterrestrial life got a big push this week from two heavyweight supporters. On Monday, Russian billionaire Yuri Milner, joined by physicist Stephen Hawking, announced a 10-year, $100 million project to scan the skies for signs of intelligent life. While various groups have been pursuing this quest for years, this new initiative will be the most comprehensive effort ever attempted. Joining us now is Andrew Simeon. He's director of the Berkeley SETI Research Center at the University of California. Thanks for being here.
Well, good morning, Barbara. Thank you for having me.
Why is this new, this project? Hasn't this been going on for years, this search?
It absolutely has. What we call the modern search for extraterrestrial intelligence, this is the types of experiments that are conducted in a way that we now consider scientific, has been going on for about 55 years. But this new $100 million breakthrough LISTEN project is going to allow us to, as you said, conduct the most sensitive and comprehensive search ever. We're going to use huge telescopes. We're going to have thousands of hours of observing time, and we're going to build state-of-the-art instruments to scan more of the radio spectrum and the optical spectrum than we've ever been able to look at before.
Exciting. Where are these telescopes located, and what kind of new electronics will the project be using to interpret and analyze all of the data?
So there are three telescopes. Two of them are radio telescopes, and one is in West Virginia. It's called the Green Bank Telescope, and the other is in Australia, and it's called the Parkes Telescope. And the new instruments, what we're actually going to be developing those at the University of California at Berkeley, where I'm based, are going to be the broadest bandwidth instruments ever. So they're going to be able to look at more of the radio spectrum than we've ever looked at before, and we're just extraordinarily excited about this new investment.
And what does $100 million mean? Why is the private investment so important?
Well, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in this country used to have a SETI program, but funding for that was terminated in 1992. And since then, we've pretty much been surviving off private donations. But never have we had something of the scale of the Breakthrough Listen initiative. And it's difficult to overstate how much of a change this is in the field. This is a factor of 10 more funding than was available in the entire world prior to this initiative.
Andrew Simeon, director of the Berkeley SETI Research Center at the University of California. Also joining us is Douglas Vakoch, director of Interstellar Message Composition, the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. There are more than one SETI Institutes. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Barbara.
So, breaking news today on this front, that NASA's Kepler telescope has uncovered what mission scientists are calling the most Earth-like planet yet, Kepler-452b. What makes it so Earth-like?
Well, it's Earth-like because it is about the same size of Earth, a little bit bigger, 60% larger than Earth. But the critical thing is it's at just the right distance from its home star that there could be liquid water on it. It's what we call the Goldilocks zone, the habitable zone around the star, so that the planet is not too close to the star, so that everything would be burned up, not so far away it would be too cold, but in this just right area. And so in effect, it's like Earth's older cousin. The star that Kepler-452b travels around is a star that is almost identical to our own sun. It's a yellow star, a class G2 star. And, you know, even if we look at the year of the planet, it's just a little bit longer than our year, 385 days. So the critical thing is that this is the closest thing that we have found to a twin of Earth. And it's around a star that is a little bit older than our star. So our sun is in our solar system about 4.5 billion years old. This is 6 billion years old. So that means it has even a little more time to evolve intelligent life that might create the technology to send the sort of signals that Andrew has been talking about in the Breakthrough Listen project. So, you know, it's great to be searching for intelligence out there, but the critical question has been, is there a planet that could be the abode for life? And with the discovery of Kepler-452b and NASA's announcement today, it looks like there are Earth-like planets everywhere.
Well, you're part of the Breakthrough Message initiative at the SETI Institute, correct?
Breakthrough Message is another component that complements the Breakthrough Listen that Andrew had talked about. And this is being headed up by Andrewian, who also was involved in the Voyager message construction. But the Breakthrough Message asks the question, what if we do detect a signal? What should we say in reply? And so this is Yuri Milner's attempt to expand the global discussion, really make it so there's not just a handful of scientists who decide whether there should be a transmission or not, and if so, what to say, but to allow people from all walks of life. And so he's establishing a prize that will give out $1 million to people from around the world who send in their own versions of a digital message that we might transmit to the aliens. Now, he's been very clear at this stage. There's no commitment to transmit that this is such a big question that it deserves a broader discussion of the philosophical, the legal, the ethical implications. But he really wants to get concrete about this prospect of it. Maybe at some point in the future we should start transmitting. And so he wants to make this a global discussion. And so that it's a real game changer. In the past, thinking about messages has often been an abstraction, but now with the kind of support and the attempt to build a global discussion, it's really getting concrete.
Douglas Vakot. Andrew Simeon with the Berkeley SETI Research Center. So following up on what Doug is saying, if scientists do hear anything, will they announce it to the public? How does this work?
Well, so that's a great question. So a very important part of Breakthrough Listen, and I think something that differentiates it from other large SETI programs in the past, is a philosophy of openness about everything about the program. So all of the software that we use to search, all of the instruments that we build, and all of the data that we collect is all going to be open to the public and scientists alike. And we're absolutely committed to transparency. And so as scientists, our most important goal when we detect a signal is to make sure that we're sure about what it is that we're detecting and what we see, and that it's not just some interference that's fooling us. But as soon as we're sure, we'll certainly let the world know both about the signal and our confidence in it.
Well, so much of this is about an act of the imagination. I'm curious, when you think of an intelligent alien, what do you imagine?
Well, that's a pretty difficult question to answer. We only know of one example of life anywhere in the universe, and that's our own planet. And to think that life would proceed in a similar way, or in fact, in any way similar at all to the development of life on this planet, is a difficult stretch to make right now based on our understanding of physics. But I imagine that, if intelligence developed here on this planet and gave such a strong evolutionary advantage to our own species, I think it's possible that it could exist somewhere else and we might be able to hear from it.
Well, we'll end on that note of scientists, asking a scientist to dream for us. Thank you so much, Andrew Simeon, director of Berkeley SETI Research Center at UC. Douglas Varkoch, thank you as well, director of the Interstellar Message Composition at SETI. And I'm Barbara Bogave. I'm in for Warren Olney. I want you to join us again for To the Point. It's produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.